Okay, let's see. So you got the basic idea.
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
That's kind of confusing me is, okay, he's realizing that he's not his thoughts or feelings, that these
right.
are internal figures. That doesn't negate the fact that Elijah just told him he has to go through this experience, right? Even though he knows that, he still has to have the outer experience. Okay.
Because the art of this is knowing what of the statements those figures make you have to submit to and what you can argue with.
Okay.
And I think the other, you know, we'll be working with this idea all along. The other implication here, you know, think of those dreams Jung had of Europe covered in bloodbath. They aren't his thoughts. They are thoughts in the world. He was just having them. And it's to also help us differentiate what should we take responsibility for and what should we not take responsibility for. And also, well, sort of a corollary of what I've just said, sometimes if those thoughts are brilliant, you think you're brilliant. And that's not so painful, but suppose you have dreams of World War I and bloodbaths, you could commit suicide. If you think you are that horrible, and what you're doing is simply receiving the horror that's going on in the collective unconscious. So it, by differentiating from these complexes, which can be experienced as thoughts or feelings, you're both saving yourself despair and inflation.
So the thoughts and feelings are coming from the collective unconscious?
Right.
Okay. And the complexes as well?
The complexes could be a personal complex or it could be a collective complex.
Okay.
It's a type of channeling. And I often wonder, you know, when people talk about channeling, if they're just simply hearing complexes. The thought went, and then he says, okay, so we just heard, can you not differentiate this thought from your own self enough so that you wish to claim it for yourself? The thought, then he says, the thought went too far for me, and I shun far-fetched ideas. Good luck, buddy. You're going to be having quite a few of them. And they are dangerous since I'm a man, and you know how much men are accustomed to seeing thoughts as their very own, so that they will eventually confuse them with themselves. See where I am? In the middle of 249, the first column.
So he's perfectly aware at this point that his thoughts aren't all...
I'd say he's becoming aware at this point.
This is part of the dying of the hero, right?
Right. The hero would think they're my thoughts. I just remember reading this guy Rutherford, the physicist who started out the work on the atom, and in one of his books he says, "Boy, I was a hell of a fellow to think of all that stuff." You know, just see, they have identified with their ideas, and you see that how ridiculous that is when you recognize at certain points in history, two people come up with the same theory independently. It wasn't their idea; it was in the collective unconscious. They just tuned into the right frequency. So this is what Jung is getting at. And in Rutherford's case, it was inflation. It's pure inflation to think like that.
How about someone like Joan of Arc, who is hearing all of those voices? Isn't she assume the hero position there?
I don't know how she would have responded to them, whether she would have said they're my voices or they were from God.
I think she said they were from God.
See, that protects you against an inflation.
Oh, okay.
And certainly the old religious viewpoint did have the effect of protecting people against inflation. And what Jung is trying to do is keep that protection, but give up that fact that it has to come from God. Because if it comes from God, then you don't argue with it. And I always tell people, you know, if you listen to everything God says, you got a little problem, because George Bush says God told me that going into Iraq was right, and they found journals of the fleeing Al-Qaeda in which Allah appeared to the soldiers and said, you must destroy the United States, which God's right. And did anyone ever stop to say, God, I'm not sure I agree with you? So that's what Jung is trying to circumvent, that kind of certainty, giving us a right to have and evaluate every aspect of our experience.
And this is where he differentiates himself from Nietzsche, who just identified.
Poor guy just identified, right.
Well, this is where he's asking that certainty to become a doubt, isn't it? Because underneath the unconscious certainty is a whole lot of shakiness. Mm-hmm. But if you let it become conscious, then you can have a doubt with certainty. Shut up, Hank.
Oh, no. I think a certainty with doubt.
But you know, I mean, it's like he said, wasn't it Jung that said doubt is the first step towards truth? I mean, because the people who shout, "Yeah, I'm," you know, "Allah is right and I'm right, and anything I do in His name
is right."
But underneath that is a whole bunch of.
Mm-hmm.
They got to have that certainty with that attribution from somebody like that, you know, to affirm their stance.
Yeah.
So.
Will you therefore, here is the powerful paragraph, I think. Will you therefore, Elijah, will you therefore confuse yourself with a tree or animal? Because you look at them and because you exist with them in one and the same world? Must you be your thoughts because you are in the world of your thoughts? But your thoughts are just as much outside yourself as trees and animals are outside your body.
I love that idea. That's
yeah.
A neat way to...
It's very helpful, I think. This, then, Jung, from time to time I will go to footnotes, not very often, but here... got on to footnote 188. Jung mentioned this conversation in the 1925 seminar and commented, only then I learned psychological objectivity. Only then could I say to a patient, be quiet, something is happening. There are such things as mice in a house. You cannot say you are wrong when you have a thought. For the understanding of the unconscious, we must see our thoughts as events, as phenomena. To then dialogue with, question, agree with, disagree with, but not say they're wrong. Usually they're wrong on, if they're wrong, quote unquote, they're wrong because we take them on the incorrect level. They're true, just on a different level.
You know, I can't help but think about all these scientific discoveries through the ages, and like you say, they'll be coming up with the same thing in a couple of different countries. And if you read the history of it'll be a race to get to it first, not how could we cooperate and get there faster. No, we've got to, like the AIDS, identifying the AIDS virus was one, and there was like great weeping and gnashing of teeth saying, I did it, the Americans, and somebody in another country said, no, we got it. And identifying the human genome, how do you say that? That was another. But no, not, I don't remember at any time did it come down to how can we cooperate to get to this cure faster? Jonas Salk, that was another one. How can we cooperate? No, we've got to race because it's got to be my discovery. My thought.
So there you're identified with the thought.
Yeah, which slows
down a bit. Mm-hmm. They could come along faster. I have a question because it's a subject.
Yeah.
But I've been thinking about it all along. We want to encounter so many Freudians now who don't know Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that is because the world is linear and they can't handle the creative thinking?
Well, I have been racking my brains on that one for about 5 years.
I really think it has to be. And like everything in law, if it's creative, it's going to be linear.
It might be an addiction to linearity.
Or an inability to handle more than linearity.
Or inability to handle more than linearity, yeah.
Yeah. That IUD life psychologist, it said, oh, no, they're facing attention to him. Well, it would have been interesting to ask him what they do pay attention to, like you pay attention to thoughts. That's what I...
Empirical research, I think. Mm-hmm. I bet they would even dismiss Freud. I don't know, but...
I mean, who does he pay attention to? That's what I was asking.
Yeah.
Mice running around in boxes, probably.
Drugs. They love them.
Well, statistics that you can prove in a business community thing, a lot of the psychology today is like, what kind of workers make the best whatever situation?
Yes.
You know, organization is like that's a thing.
Yeah, they try to prove what they want to.
They can fix those stats,
so they do. Yeah. Just like
the government. But, you know, going back to what Linda was saying, mm-hmm. the competition versus cooperation, somewhere, and I haven't yet found it, but Jung says competition is bad for the soul.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know where that is?
No, but if you're fine, let me know.
I'm on the search, but
I know in memories, very early on, he says how he hated competition.
Okay.
I think it's, you know, remember he says he got his foot caught in a bridge or something. He was saying that he had a resistance to life, and he was crossing a bridge, and he stepped on a board that broke, and his foot went through the board, and he was stuck on this swinging bridge. And he says in there, so around there, that he hated competition.
Because a lot of that, I mean, competition, if you look at it, is like the hero.
Absolutely.
Part of the hero complex. And, you know, and the world is so ruled by competition.
So ruled by competition.
That we really do inhibit our own discoveries. And it just, I was just... That's the hero. That's part of the hero.
Yeah.
That competition.
It's hard. I won't mention the school, but I have a client whose daughter plays volleyball for a local high school. They have driven those kids so much to win, her 14-year-old daughter has already had an injury that required surgery. 14-year-old. Win. It's insane.
Little league moms are just the same.
Yeah, it's a soccer mom phenomenon. I mean, it's this. I just got to be kidding.
The funny thing is, it's not coming from the shell; it's coming from the adult.
Yeah, of course it's coming from the adult. Yeah, and this poor kid. I mean, what? 14. She's already had major surgery on her knee.
What's like? That's a spirit of the times thing because you know we put kids in sports. So they can learn coordination, and everybody gets a trophy and keep score, and you know that goes on for a very long time. And then, but the kids can tell you who won. The parents are screaming on the sideline. I mean, to the point that I just said we're not doing sports anymore because I don't like to be yelled to.
Mm-hmm.
And the, it, you know, the, so it's laughable that they're saying that, no, we don't want kids to be competitive. Everybody wins. Everybody gets a trophy. And you see the kids going, yeah, I didn't deserve that. Yeah. So,
I guess it'd be a trip in that.
You can ask any kid on any field who won, and they know. And their parents do, too. So the spirit of the Depths is saying this is critically important.
I think so.
The spirit of the Times is saying, oh, let's give it a trophy.
Yeah.
Well, you know, even in this conflict between Islam and Christianity, you know, there's competition of who's the better God, who's righter than the others. You know, I mean, that's competition. Yeah. Another.
And that's going to be winners and losers. We're going to take over the world.
Right.
Or else we're going to take over the world.
Right.
Yeah, I wasn't really blowing it up, but we're not church.
Yeah, that's what bothered me about the movie The Kite Runner. You ever seen that? There was a winner and a loser at the end.
Almost. Isn't that human nature? Is a winner and a loser.
Yes, I think it is, but we've got to transform that nature.
Or educate us somehow.
Mm-hmm. I mean, competing against oneself is the real deeper meaning of competition.
Is the word you said?
Competing against oneself.
Is the what?
Is the real meaning of competition.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
That's what the Lord has put out, too.
Yeah.
And I had kids on some team, and that was really the beauty of us, were competing against themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I understand my thought. World was for me more word than world. I thought of my thought, world, it is I. So he's just saying, yeah, I realized that I really didn't live this out. Does that make sense? Elijah, do you say to your human world and every being outside of you, you are I? So they're just wrapping up that discussion. I stepped into your house, my father, with the fear of a schoolboy, but you taught me salutary wisdom. I can also consider my thoughts as being outside myself. That helps me to return to that terrible conclusion that my tongue is reluctant to express. I thought that Salome loves me because I resemble John or you. See, that's the route to inflation. This thought seemed unbelievable to me. That's why I rejected it and thought that she loves me because I'm really quite opposite to you, that she loves her badness in my badness. This thought was devastating. Elijah is silent. Heaviness lies upon me. Then Salome steps in, comes over to me, and lays her arm around my shoulder. She takes me for her father, in whose chair I sat. I dare neither move nor speak. Salome, I know that you are not my father. You are his son, and I am your sister. You, Salome, my sister, was this terrible attraction that emanated from you, that unnameable horror of you, of your touch, who was our mother? Mary. New theme. Mary has entered. So Mary is the daughter of a prostitute. Is it a hellish dream? Mary, our mother, what madness lurks in your words? The mother of our Savior, our mother, when I crossed your threshold today, I saw calamity. Alas, it has come. Are you out of your senses, Salome? Elijah, protector of the divine laws, speak. Is this a devilish spell cast by the rejected? How can she say such a thing, or are both of you out of your senses? Are you symbols and Mary is a symbol? I am simply too confused to see through you now. Well, maybe just take a second there. What does it mean that Mary has entered the picture? Has entered the picture. I think more.
Mary is the Virgin.
Mary is the mother of Christ.
So the way to the new God image.
I think this is the way to the new God image. Yeah, exactly. That where Mary gave birth to Christ, then now Mary is giving birth to a new understanding of what sacred is. Sacred is the dialogue with these figures. Sacred is what's going to come out of the dialogue with these figures. Now, Jung doesn't say that. That's my sense. But I think that's why it's so important and so shocking to him. Uh, You may call us symbols for the same reason that you can also call your fellow men symbols if you wish, but we are just as real as your fellow men. See, there is the foundation of the reality of the psyche. You invalidate nothing and solve nothing by calling us symbols. Does that make sense? Because they are psychic realities that are shaping Jung's life. Just like a person would shape them, shape just like a person shapes us, our complexes shape us. I think that's what he's getting at. And then he says, you plunge me into terrible confusion. Elijah, we are certainly what you call real, so that we have to take our complexes as seriously as we take other people.
Actually, the complexes would shape us more because they have the power of the self in God.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a huge, larger...
He's just getting that straight now. I'm silent. Salome has removed herself. Uncertainly, I look around. Behind me, a high golden flame. Red flame burns on a round altar. The serpent has encircled the flame. Its eyes glitter with golden reflections. Swaying, I turn to the exit. As I step out into the hall, I see a powerful lion going before me. Outside, it is a wide, cold, starry night. I say, well, we'll see that lion again. That's the act of imagination. Okay, now he starts to comment. So comment follows. It is no small matter to acknowledge one's yearning. You see what's so important there. We've kind of talked about it. He's just used a new word.
Yearning, desire, passion.
Yeah. All this stuff starts when you yearn for something. What's he yearning for? I think Tony Wolf.
When he says that, I know that you're not, Salome says, I know you're not my father, you are his son, and I am your sister, then does that make his yearning for her even worse because now it's incest? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, but it's also a recognition that you are intimately part of me.
Exactly.
Okay, good.
And we don't know this yet, but this idea of incest can mean regression. That would be the disgusting part. It can also mean, and it shows up in dreams, when you're about to take a step, that you need to take, but which breaks your own rules or break society's rules, you'll dream of incest. So that's what Jung adds to Freud. For Freud, incest is regressive. For Jung, it can be a breaking the taboo which wants to prohibit self-knowledge. And I'd go with it in that sense, I think, Tammy, that the sister is, this whole inner journey is breaking a taboo. That a real man puts his energy into the outer world. Now, we know to doubt that today. He didn't know to doubt that then. So the idea of being, you know, a successful psychoanalyst, psychiatrist, living in the best area of town, who doesn't go to all the right parties but spends his evenings writing these crazy ideas, see, that's incest as far as the psyche is concerned. For this, many need to make a particular effort at honesty. Like Bob Dylan, you know, to break the law, you have to be honest. All too many do not want to know where their yearning is, because it would seem to them impossible or too distressing. Now, that may be a reason, Karin, why linear thinking is so attractive, because if you engage in non-linear thinking, you open yourself up to your yearning, and you're liable to end up in an awful mess.
But linear is more protective?
I think linear is protective, yeah.
You have more choice if you're not linear. I mean, linear like, goes from year to year to year.
Yeah.
But if you're not in that, then you come to these unpredictable things.
Right.
But, you know, we say choices like that's a good thing, but for people who are very linear, it's decision. And if you make a decision, then there's a chance that you're going to be wrong. And there is a right or wrong where people like us say, well, it's just maybe, you know, let's just see what happens and survive it. And I don't see linear thinkers being too happy with survival.
But this is big, this yearning stuff, because he's presupposing that you have integrated Freud's insights. On the importance of eros and yearning. And I think, you know, people with very rigid character structures are rigid because if they weren't, they'd be perverts. This is sort of not a big database, but I've seen several really big Nazarenes. Every one of them underneath was a psychopath. That veneer of rigid morality was simply a protection. If you tell them, follow your yearning, you know, they'd be out being a pedophile. The yearning is in such horrible shape. What one yearns for is so primitive that it simply can't be entertained.
Or they might just go crazy.
Might just go crazy, yeah.
Another thing is with yearning, once you recognize it and work with it, then that comes with it a huge responsibility to respond to it. And that is not easy either.
Yeah, to respond to it and to maintain your values in responding to it.
And thinking what he was yearning for at that moment that was consuming him and how to maintain his values.
Yeah.
And make sense of that. Mm-hmm. That had to discombobulate him.
I remember talking to a Vietnam vet once. He just said, you know, for me, the worst thing about being in Vietnam is you'd see these guys in war where all rules were off, and what they would do in terms of gratuitous torture and murder, I just couldn't believe. They weren't there just fighting war. They were just being madmen. And I think that's this unexamined yearning is very dangerous, but Jung has examined his yearning with his work with Freud, and it's still problematic, but it's not insane. there was that line at the end of Chinatown. Remember Chinatown? If I remember it correctly, it's John Ford playing the old guy, and he's talking to Jack Nicholson, and he says, because the Ford character had fathered a daughter from his daughter, if I remember that correctly. And that's the woman that Nicholson had fallen for.
Faye Dunaway.
It was Faye Dunaway. Mm-hmm. And the Nicholson character is confronting the John Ford character. Well, why'd you do this, you bastard? And the character says, Mr. Giddes, few people ever have the opportunity to realize under the right time, in the right time and under the right circumstances, they are capable of doing just anything. And that's what Jung is opening up. What do I really want, whether right or wrong? And it's a scary question, because what often comes up is so horrible that we just shut down the question. That's basing psychology in the body. You know, you might say, what does the body want? For this, many need to make a particular effort at honesty. So you have to be honest to do this. All too many do not want to know where their yearning is, because it would seem to them impossible or too distressing. And yet, yearning is the way of life. If you do not acknowledge your yearning, then you do not follow yourself, but go on foreign ways that others have indicated for you. I think that is an amazing paragraph. So you do not live your life, but an alien one. But who should live your life if you do not live it? So that is, we've said this, that Jung is going into his yearning. His yearning is putting him in touch with Tony Wolfe, and he's saying, I'm going to go with him. He realizes all the trouble that portends, because Salome is blind, Salome is a henchman, and so on. The end of that paragraph, since you can only live your own life.
How do you know with yearning whether to go with it or not? I mean, I suppose that Jung's attraction, instead of being for somebody who's only to explore a 13 or 14 year old girl, and he's 40, and the passion's just as real, and she seems to be returning it, but there are a whole lot of reasons that would be so much worse than, you know, just deciding. How do you know, how does he know that this yearning is okay to follow, and that the damage is, I guess, containable, versus something like, I'm after my own daughter, or I'm after her friend, or I'm a young boy? I mean, you could just go on and on, the things that some people could see.
I think the key word is honest. Many need to make a peculiar effort at honesty. That would be a criminal thing to do. And so the honesty in Jung would not allow him to do that.
Okay. Yeah, you know, honesty, of course, a spooky word. Because honesty is one thing to one person and another thing to another person.
What word is that, sir?
Honesty.
Oh, honesty.
Well, yes, but that's kind of philosophical. In other words, and I think these questions are relevant, because this whole thing, we have to remember, is done by a moral man. This does not apply to immoral people or dishonest people. You know, I think somebody said to Jung, was talking about following the will of God, and somebody said, well, if God told you to murder somebody, would you? And he said, no. So that this only applies when the individual has integrity. And that is an enormous assumption.
you know, the town with all flexibility.
Right. Not that there aren't gray areas, but that what we have to do is reconcile desire and values.
I mean, everything on you is my outside life, but I would assume that he and Emma had many conversations and that they came to the conclusion that this would not destroy their relationship. Mm-hmm. And so that was a major component in him saying this is... this is not going to be as destructive as just going into it without having and maintaining an Eros relationship with your wife. So, I mean,
that's very important. That's the honesty that he told Emma what he was doing,
and that they, I assume it was a mutual.
I know it was, because the guy who supervised me told me Emma and Tony came to him to work on their relationship.
I mean, you know, that, I mean, to me, that makes it so much more honest, so much more moral than just going hiding behind some of that.
Yeah, I think it makes it much more comfortable for us to read, because we know who's involved. But it takes it away from the collective unconscious.
What do you mean?
I can't see everybody having this kind of mentality.
And first of all, not everyone has that much libido. Second of all, I don't think most people are this honest. A friend of mine in business said in the last 10 years, she's seen the business practices get increasingly immoral. So I think on the whole, we are dealing with a society of dishonest people. So those two things would make this very dangerous for public consumption. Yeah.
I know enough about what's happened in the last 2 years to the government, to this country.
Mm-hmm.
How much immorality there's been.
Yeah. Something else I was going to say that. I know. And be willing to pay the price for it. Now, what I got this secondhand, but what I've understood is that Jung really wanted to teach this stuff at the University of Zurich. He was told, you can have a position if you keep Tony Wolf in the background. He said, no, I won't keep her in the background. He lost his position. You see, you have to be willing to pay the price. He could have made Tony an accessory, but he kept her importance very much in the front of his life. That's an honest man.
Yeah, that's very honest, but it's also a rationalized position.
What do you mean?
Well, what I mean is that the school of a lot of homogenous life is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true. I'd be wanting Tony in the background. Mm-hmm. But he was not going to do that.
He was not going to do that.
So that's what intrigues me about the values, the integrity, the truth. It's so easy to rationalize.
Yeah, probably all those guys had mistresses who said that. Mm-hmm. You know, and so if you can keep her as your mistress, you can join our club. Mm-hmm. He said no thanks. Yeah. And that's why we're meeting here and not in any university, I'm sure. Because at that point, Jungian psychology and academia went two different ways.
Was there anything
that... Not that I know of.
Not necessarily, but...
CTS.
They did last.
CTS.
They did last year.
Last year, but you don't know about that.
It'll be 2 years before they'll bring another year.
Oh, well, that's really good. I know the mail.
So at this point, though, Jung's not really looking at broader implications like we are. He's just trying to figure out the whole Tony Wolf thing. Right?
I think he's just trying to make a decision and reconcile it with his conscience. What do I feel? What do I have to do, and why?
I sometimes get hung up on when I absolutely agree that it was very honest and
moral of him to say, no, I won't put Tony in the background, but if it meant that his ability to support his children was compromised, then it's like, well, where's the greater responsibility, and where does the integrity come in? And you know, and those are the things that I wrestle with, and so I'm trying to put it in context of where...
Yeah. Well, he didn't have to worry about money, you know.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, his wife was stinking rich. Emma Young was rich.
Oh, well, that would make being moral much easier.
I'm not sure. Imagine that the one who's paying the mortgage is the one who's saying, you we're going to deal with this. I think he probably made a decent living, would have made a decent living as a psychiatrist, but I mean, that house of theirs is, no mortal could afford that. And just in today's dollars, it would be $100 million. That would have been easy. I think she was like a Rockefeller of Switzerland.
So she's part of his morality.
So he has a lot to lose.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. He had a lot to lose. He would have been living in a three-room apartment.
But he didn't have to worry about his other... I mean, his children would be taken care of. He
yeah.
would support himself.
And I think if, let's say, she had ended the relationship, and which, if she had withdrawn her funds, as a psychiatrist, he would have made enough money to support his kids. You don't need that much money in Switzerland because you got free education, free transportation. So, you know.
I think to your point, like, I think of the people who were living in Nazi Germany and had to make a choice, you know, if I do not follow the Nazi party, they will come and they will kill me, and they will kill my wife and children.
Yeah.
And some people made that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and they didn't say we're going to kill you. They would say we're going to kill your wife and children. Absolutely. Thank God he didn't have to deal with that. But. Well, let's see. We got as far as... not bad for return. Second, we got... I'd say we did the first paragraph of number 2 on page 249. So, how far did we get? 2 full pages? Two and a half. I'm just wondering whether you ought to read ahead. You got through to the end of the first part.
Right.
You didn't get that far?
No, I said I don't think we're going to get that.
Oh, you don't think we'll get that far next time?
There's
so I shouldn't assign any more than that?
There's an awful lot of
okay.
that resolution.
That's true. There is.
The resolution?
The resolution is where it really gets interesting, I think, because it does get resolved. What I can tell you, shall I ruin it for you, or you want to wait? Wait? Oh. Well, okay, I'm not going to tell you. It does get resolved. And I think it is so beautiful by the time it gets resolved that it just, I don't know what to say, moves me incredibly what this man did and how this thing resolved and what came out of it. It will be fantastic. All this dark stuff, all the nitpicking we've been doing about imagery will pay off. It is really going somewhere. And I think the fact that we saw the scarab after the death of the hero was foreshadowing that this would be a creative process. It was a descent into absolute emotional chaos, which led to order, and a creative order. A beautiful, and Jungian psychology came out of this.
Isn't it too bad we couldn't make it required reading for the world?
Well, the problem is that it presupposes an honest mind to read it. Now, that's the problem, I think. So I guess don't read anything else. If you want to, you can just get ahead of the next section a little bit, but I doubt whether we'll get that far, because this is so important.
Gary, was the relationship very destructive, though, to Tony Moore?
She never married. She too was rich, from a rich family. I got the feeling she was lonely. Did she have another lover? I have no idea. She certainly would have been in a position, you know. They remained friends to her death. And, you know, I think the price that was paid by everybody wasn't physical. It was emotional, heartache and longing.
I guess I think maybe it was good in that she found, I mean, that was the way in this group, that she was her friends, but I'm sure socially it was a huge friend to take.
I'm sure. And, you know, she became an analyst herself. And one of the guys I worked with her. You know, very competent. Was there a stigma? You know, there's not the stigma in Europe that there is here. I don't know exactly what it would have been like for her later in life. She was from a respectable family. That probably carried some weight, you know. So there must have been a loneliness that remained because she wanted to marry him. Okay, see you in 2 weeks then.